Hey everyone, Laszlo Montgomery again. If the title of today's episode looks familiar, that's because it is. 5 years ago, when this free public service was launched, the inaugural topic was, in fact, Qin Shi Huang. It's weighed heavy on my mind all these years that I shoehorned that entire massive topic and all its historical mythology into a mere 18-minute episode. I guess in the grand scheme of things, when considering Chinese history, Qin Shi Huang, he's a pretty important guy. So if Sir YK Bao got 75 minutes, surely the Qin Emperor should get more than 18 minutes. So in this episode, Qin Shi Huang is getting a long, overdue total makeover. This is such an interesting topic on so many levels. Qin Shi Huang and the mausoleum and the terracotta warriors sort of suck all the oxygen out of the room as far as the memorable achievements of the Qin. The supernova of the first emperor and his mausoleum takes one's eyes off the series of events that led up to 221 BCE and the long-lasting legacy these times produced. This story's been told before, but let's kick back and groove on it one more time. Our story today examines those 5 centuries leading up to 221 BCE, the year Qin Shi Huang kicked off his 10-year run as the first ever emperor of China. A lot has been made of the fact that, as great as he was only emperor for 10 years and his dynasty didn't last long. The first emperor of China. Not a king, an emperor. No one ever used that title before. Emperor of what? China didn't exist until the Qin Emperor. No one was identifying with being a Zhongguo Ren. If you came from Zhao, that was your whole world. The people of Zhao didn't necessarily speak Chinese exactly the same as the people in Qi. And they certainly didn't speak it like they did in Chu, Yue, Ba, or Shu. So although we refer to the mythical Xia, the Shang, and the 7.5 centuries of the Zhou as ancient China, well, that would have been news to those people who lived back then. The concept of a single Chinese state hadn't been thought up yet. And Chinese characters? Pre-Qin Dynasty, the large seal script style of writing inherited from the Zhou, differentiated from state to state. The way they wrote horse and yen wasn't exactly the same as in Chu. So no one yet had this idea of a single, unified Chinese state. Maybe you could compare it to the American colonies in the late 1600s, early 1700s. The idea that these different colonies in Maryland, New York, South Carolina, and Georgia would all unite to form one country wasn't in the minds of anyone just yet. That's maybe the most important thing we can credit the first Qin Emperor for. He was the first to conquer all the principal states and join everyone together. All the sidebars about burning books, burying scholars, conscripting millions of peasants for all these building projects is just parlor talk compared to the main achievement. He united all the separate states of China into one country, and as an encore, instituted reforms in government and throughout the land that lasted almost to the very end of imperial Chinese history. The Xia Dynasty and Qin Shi Huang have something in common in that both their stories pretty much ride on whatever Sima Qian left behind for us in the records of the grand historian, the Shiji. And the Shiji, as we can buy it today on Amazon, wasn't discovered until the Song Dynasty. So given that double disconnect, it's hard to separate the myths from the facts. But you have to hand it to these scholars in China, modern day and the ones who came before. They did manage to find out quite a lot about the Qin society, and about Qin Shi Huang. Everyone knows the story about the farmers in Lintong, Shanxi province, who were digging a well and found the terracotta warriors instead. That is only the tip of the iceberg as far as what else has been uncovered since and what still lies beneath the ground in any direction within 100 miles of Lintong. And every year, something is dug up that fits another piece to the ongoing story of the Qin and the first emperor of a unified China. Since, basically, all we know about Qin Shi Huang is what Sima Qian tells us, we have no choice but to go with that. He got the Shang Dynasty right, so maybe when he says Qin Shi Huang had the voice of a jackal, he had it on good authority. After all, when you look at it this way, Sima Qian died around 85 BCE, or 135 years after Qin Shi Huang passed. from today's perspective, in 2015, that'd be 1880, Rutherford B. Hayes. I guess you could say from an historical perspective, at least, that's still somewhat fresh. So maybe all the dumping Sima Qian does on the Qin Emperor wasn't all just Han Confucian scholars trying to put the Qin down to build themselves up. I found it interesting that every source I read said he was born in the year 259, with no month or date of birth. But Wikipedia's cheat sheet calls his birth February 7th, 260 BCE. If that was so, that's quite a coincidence that the first emperor shares the same February 7th birthday with the last emperor, Puyi, 21 and a half centuries apart, to the day. Believe it or not. I couldn't substantiate that anywhere else. February 7th, also the fateful day when Pan Am 101 from LHR, carrying the Fab Four, landed at JFK in 1964. The story of the Qin begins in 897 BCE, still Alba Longa days in Western Civ. Romulus and Remus are still 126 years in the future. The people of Qin had their first big break when someone there was granted a right to breed horses for the Zhou kings. This someone had been granted the surname Ying, and from that day forward, the rulers of this place would all be surnamed Ying. The Qin emperor's name was Ying Zheng. His father was Ying Zhuangxiang. Try as they might all throughout the centuries, the Qin couldn't wipe off the taint that led them to be disparaged by the people from the east, who called them wild, uncivilized, and not like them, the Huaxia people who would one day call themselves the true Chinese. For now, an aristocracy who all considered themselves part of a single superior culture carried the banner for this embryonic Chinese state. The Qin were not among them, at least not in the eyes of these high-born Yellow River Valley aristocrats. The Qin state that later on will develop in the Wei River Valley near Xi'an in its earliest days was located way out west in Gansu's second city, in present-day Tianshui. These Qin ancestors were Western Rong people. Before the Xiongnu became the scourge of the North China Plain, there were the Rong. They had been around since Shang days, but far out to the west. Distance kept them apart from the central China plain. By the time of the Zhou, they were a constant source of stress. The Rong, and there were several tribes of them, were just one of the Siyi, the four barbarians of the day, along with the Dongyi, Beidi, and the Nanman. These so-called Yi people, barbarians, surrounded the embryonic Chinese state that will hatch in 221 BCE. Sima Qian says the Qin's ancestors came from these Rong people. If so, it's ironic that in 314, the Qin military, after a couple knockdowns throughout the centuries, are going to be the ones who finish the Rong off. Probably these Qin ancestors weren't Rong and only just intermarried with them. Either way, all the noses from out east look down on the good people of Qin due to their dubious ancestry. Wrong or no wrong, these Qin people acted as the proxies for the Zhou kings in the fight against these nomads from the west. The next in a series of big breaks for the Qin came when their leader, Du Xiang, was formally granted a fiefdom of his own. This happened when the Zhou king You was murdered by the invading Rong, and the ruling Ji family of the Zhou were chased out of the capital. The royals fled east, where a new capital was set up in Luoyang, though back then it was called Chengzhou. And it was this sixth Qin ruler, Duke Xiang, Qin Xianggong, who escorted the new Zhou King Ping to this new eastern capital. And here, in 771 BCE, began the Eastern Zhou Dynasty. This was all discussed back in CHP episodes 16 and 17, covering the Zhou. Their third big break came in the form of Duke Xiang's son, Duke Wen, who had the good fortune to reign for 50 years. He was the one who got the job done, as far as at least neutralizing the Rong in 750 BCE. After returning lands seized by the Rong back to the Zhou king, Duke Wen of Qin reaped some nice rewards from the grateful Ji family in Luoyang. the Qin rulers had officially arrived. In return for being there at the right time, the Qin were granted special status by the Zhou and were now officially on a roll. If they could just finish off the Rong, for sure their fortunes would rise. Promises were made to them of land and honors. By the late 7th century BCE, the Qin had already begun their slow march eastward from Gansu to the Wei River Valley, where Xi'an was located. The history of the Warring States is long, drawn out, and complicated, and made many times more complicated if you're not a Chinese speaker. Keeping all these names of lords, dukes, kings, place names, battles, treaties, alliances, states, and territories straight it's a lot to ask of anyone. I've listened to lectures, watched videos, and listened to other podcasts, and that's a lot of detail to take in. For the entirety of the Spring and Autumn and Warring States periods that made up the Eastern Zhou, there were so many contenders, all either knocking each other off or allying with each other for survival or to knock someone else off. After a shakeout period that began in the Eastern Zhou, there evolved a small number of contenders in core China, the Yellow River Plain. This covered most of modern-day Shanxi and Shanxi, a sliver of Hubei, most of Henan and Hebei, all of Shandong, and half of Anhui. At the time of Yu the Great, the Huaxia Chinese heartland was no bigger than a modern-day province. Next, under the Shang, China as we know it was maybe 4 times the size of Texas. And during the Zhou, China wasn't that much bigger than it was in the Shang. The fortunes of the Qin kingdom received a nice bump under Duke Mu, Qin Mu Gong. He ruled 659 to 621, a period when kings were ruling in Rome. Romulus had been dead for less than a century. Gaius Marius was still 500 years in the future. Duke Mu was already the 14th ruler of Qin. He was one of the 5 hegemons of the day, along with the rulers of Qi, Song, Jin, and Chu, though not one of the Ba Wang, or hegemons. The rulers of Wu and Yue in the lower reaches of the Yangtze were also considered no slouches when it came to fighting. The Wu state was led by King He Liu, who we featured front and center in that CHP 111 episode covering the Wu state. And, spoiler alert, when the Qin finish their conquest, China will bulk up to a size that will just about stay the same all the way up to the Qing dynasty, when the Manchus pushed China's borders out to the limits we know today. But that's still a ways off. The Battle of Jinyang in present-day Taiyuan in 450 BCE and the defeat of the Jir state lit the spark that lit the fuse that led to the Sanjia Fen Jin, the partition of Jin between 434 and 403 BCE. The partition of this state of Jin was one of those things that no one believed could ever happen. The Jin had been the perennial badasses of the north for the longest time, and no one ever liked to mess with them. But how the mighty sometimes fall. Indeed, they went down hard, and from their carcass arose the successor states of Zhao, Wei, and Han. These three dominated the Yellow River Valley and will make it to the finals of the 7 warring states, the Qixiong. These remaining 7 states will fight or bargain for survival, and of course, in the end, 221 BCE, the Qin, led by King Yingzheng, emerge victorious. This partition of Jin and the changes in dynamic it caused set the stage for the next phase of the Warring States period. The 2.5 centuries of the Warring States period, end of the 5th century till 221 BCE, is going to witness a complete transformation of Chinese society in manners, economics, and in philosophy. China was cut up this way. The Qin stronghold was in the Wei River Valley, Shanxi, Gansu. The Han, Wei, and Zhao covered the Yellow River Valley. The Qi state had their capital in Linzi in Shandong, just east of modern-day Zibo. The Chu were down in the middle reaches of the Yangtze, Hubei, around there. Last was Yen, around the environs of present-day Beijing. That was eastern Zhou China on the eve of the War for Unification. From the time of Duke Xiang in the 8th century up to the mid-4th century BCE, the Qin slowly consolidated their power and integrated themselves with Zhou Dynasty China, as disunited as it was. Everything changed for the Qin mid-4th century BCE. That was the turning point, not only for the Qin state, but for the future Chinese state as well. Anything great or long-lasting about the Qin had its roots planted right here. There was one man perhaps most responsible for laying the groundwork for all the Qin conquests and the societal changes within the Qin state. So before we begin this story of Xiangyang, let's talk about all the amazing and deadly effective new ways to commit mass slaughter on the battlefield. That also began around this time, 4th and 5th century BCE. A few things happened that really impacted what a battlefield looked like when it was all over. Anyone who listened to Dan Carlin tell the story of World War I and his Countdown to Armageddon series recalls how the Western powers had this great leap forward industrially. And one of the many things that sprang from this was the design and manufacture of weapons that could cause hitherto unknown quantities of death and destruction. It changed the whole nature of war. In between cataclysmic conflicts between opposing powers, sometimes there would be this huge advance in some technology. Like when automatic machine guns suddenly appeared in 1862 with the Gatling gun, and especially 1883 with the Maxim machine gun. Total game changers. Mid-Eastern Zhou, China had its own similar moment. Pretty much up to this time, combat was just like you see in those old serial dramas. Hand-to-hand combat, three-man chariots, spears, bow and arrow. Man, to kill someone back then in battle, you really had to get right up close and do it. Swords began to show up in battle mid-6th century BCE, and cavalry, too, started to become more common. But it was very up close and personal. The Maxim gun of its day that led to such a seismic change on the battlefield was the invention of the crossbow by the Qin. This was quite a step up from the bow and arrow. And in the right hands, they were deadly accurate from as far away as 150 meters. The Iron Age was starting, which led to all kinds of improvements in agricultural tools and higher crop yields. And let me mention, a few changes in the battlefield, too. The Qin are going to take their sweet time transitioning from bronze to iron. With the secret of iron came the invention of the axe that allowed men, for the first time in history, to cut down trees and learn about the downsides of deforestation. So many trees were cut down in the middle reaches of the Yellow River Valley back then that the phenomenon of this terrible silting of China's sorrow began. These were some pretty big changes going on. Not only was the Eastern Zhou period a most fertile time in Chinese philosophy, it was just as fruitful in the new technologies and inventions that came to the fore. And Joseph Needham's work that we discussed last time, Science and Civilization in China, proved all that. Along with all these new weapons of war and other technologies that provided additional benefits to fighting battles, was the fundamental change in how battles were fought. Besides crossbows, added to the mix of weaponry were spears, 7 meters long, a kind of halberd that was like an axe on the end of a pole. This Qin weapon could both slice and stab from a safer distance than with a sword. There are also these kinds of daggers, or pi, that was fixed to a 3.5 meter pole. Think of it as a long bayonet without the gun. And soldiers started wearing lamellar armor for the first time. You see a lot of the Qin emperor's terracotta warriors wearing this stuff. These were layered leather plates studded with metal that gave the infantry some protection whenever some sword came crashing down on them. From the 5th to the 3rd century BCE, the age of infantry development evolved. In the Xia, the Shang, and the Western Zhou, war was squarely in the domain of the nobles and their knights. They raised armies, and though there was plenty of gruesome killing, these battles were small, and an army of 10,000 was considered massive. Remember, Alexander the Great conquered the world with something like 50,000 men. The age of the huge armies hadn't arrived. But now, during the Warring States period, the numbers were pumped up to the six figures. No longer was war and battle solely the domain of the aristocrats and their knights. The Qin leaders by the mid-4th century knew the same thing Gaius Marius knew, and what no less a person than Chairman Mao also knew. Ren duo, hao ban shi. When you have a lot of people to do the job, it's much easier. When you scale up the army to 1 or 200,000 soldiers carrying all the latest weapons of the day, some serious damage could be inflicted. Starting in the 4th century BCE, siege warfare will develop, and now there was a whole new way to conquer an enemy from the other side of their high protective walls. The Chu army from down south near Hubei, they were the first to start bulking up and trying out this new mass infantry for size. As Marius would later do, the Qin hung out a little red meat that attracted the new men of the day who, in exchange for these nice benefits, picked up a weapon and got counted and joined the Qin army. And one other thing, these minor nobles of the Eastern Zhou, many of these Shi, as they were called, these educated aristocratic knights, they were wooed by the dukes and kings of the day to help with the civil administration of these newly beefed up states. And the character Shi, which had always meant a knight, now took on a more literary meaning for this emerging class of civil administrators. The office of Zaixiang, or chief minister, was first seen during the time of Prince Wen of Wei, 445 to 395, and was adopted by the Qin King Huiwen, who reigned 338 to 311 BCE. In the Qin state, things were trending in the direction of a kind of political system that called for civil servants to be chosen and paid for by the state. And if they didn't perform, they were dismissed or banished. They were under the control of the central power and served as an extension of his power and a means to project his power over a much greater distance than the Zhou kings were able to do. The idea called for dividing up all the territory in the most efficient and logical way and turn each block into an administrative district that made it easier to mobilize, organize, collect taxes, reward, punish, and control. And the man who made it all possible was Shang Yang. He came to the Qin from his home in Wei State in 359 BCE. With the support of his benefactor, Duke Xiao of Qin, Shang Yang instituted far-reaching changes throughout society from the top down to the most remote and common peasant. There was no room for these aristocratic nobles who had had their way since the time of the Shang kings. As the power and effectiveness of the infantry grew in the 300s and 200s BCE, these former surrounding feudal lords and statelets who in their day defied and brought down many a king or competing lord, themselves found it hard to maintain a life to which they had become accustomed, not to mention a whole new way of fighting battles. 4th, 5th century BCE, iron and all its uses in agriculture just transformed the countryside and China's world-famous gigantic population right here has its first great leap. It will happen throughout Chinese history when new technologies brought improvements to agriculture, and if relative peace and prosperity could last a few generations, what follows is a big boost in population. This happened in the Song and again in the Ming, then it was to almost spike in the Qing. Not until iron tools and implements transformed the countryside could you support these kinds of large population centers, all concentrated in one general area. Now it was possible, and almost at once these cities began to rise. And by the way, this phase China enters into with the Qin is the final one where the only foods people ate were whatever was indigenous to the lands they occupied. Once the Han Dynasty starts and the Silk Road gets cranked up, China will be inundated with new foods, sauces, spices, and cooking methods. So let's get back to Shang Yan. His benefactor was Duke Xiao, Qin Xiaogong. He lived 381 to 338 BCE and began his rule of the Qin state in 361. Alexander III of Macedon at this time was only 4 years old and hadn't earned the moniker the Great yet. But both Duke Xiao and Alexander inherited the reins of power at about the same age, though 25 years separated their times of great conquest. Duke Xiao had 23 years in the hot seat. The Qin had sort of fallen on hard times when Duke Xiao took over. Not since Duke Mu, almost 300 years before, had the Qin made any enemies quake in their boots. Duke Xiao was determined to do something about this. In the history books, I guess the best thing people have said about Duke Xiao was that he was smart enough to find and employ Shang Yan. And when Shang Yan was ripping out all the carpeting, pulling down the ceilings, and blowing up everything the nobles had held so dear for so long, Duke Xiao stood by his man and protected him. And within a few years after his benefactor, Duke Xiao, died, Shang Yan found himself tied up to 5 horse carriages, and when someone yelled, "Giddy up," he got ripped apart. This was the old Chulie penalty. And because Duke Xiao's successor, King Huiwen, really didn't like Shang Yan, he also imposed the sentence of Julian Jiuzu, a.k.a. Zhu Zhu. That meant when Shang Yan went down, so did his whole family. Parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren, siblings, uncles, and uncle's spouses. They all had to go. So let's look at what poor old Shang Yan did to deserve all that. Well, he transformed the Qin state. That's what he did. He put this system in place in Qin that 6 generations later, the first Qin emperor rolled out across the entirety of the newly conquered and united Chinese nation. And by doing that, the first Qin emperor put the software and hardware in place that allowed a central authority to project power and manage the entirety of the new united China, right down to the village level. And even though the Qin dynasty didn't last long, it did unify China for at least a while. So no one could say anymore that it couldn't be done. So later on, when Xiang Yu and Liu Bang contend for supremacy from 206 to 202 BCE, they both knew what the stakes were. The reforms that led to all that began with Shang Yan in 359 BCE. He had first stumbled upon these new ways of doing things in his travels to Qi and to Jin. One of the most core ideas introduced was the whole notion of giving land to the peasants in return for military service and a host of other legal obligations. The obvious effects of Shang Yan's reforms were threefold. First, the size of the army was able to be vastly increased. So not only were there all these great new weapons and ways to wage battle, now there were huge masses of these soldiers who knew how to swing a halberd. Before long, a large, well-trained, and well-armored infantry became the only way to fight. And with such a massive army, the dependence on the nobility to provide military support ended. Now the central authority controlled everything, and with this new merit system in place, it turned soldiers into the most vicious killers. For the first time, a roadmap to economic advancement in society was now wholly possible for the peasants. The third major reform involved the implementation of a single, uniform administration and a set of laws for the entire population, and everything was based on universal military service. There were 25 ranks one had to climb to get to the top. The roadmap was clear as far as how one rose up the ranks. You had to kill and show success on the battlefield. A whole military merit reward system was implemented. How many heads you handed in at the end of the day determined where you stood in the system, and this determined the kinds of perks you and your family received in Qin society. There were no surprises. It was a rigid and organized system. Then, without the aid of drones, helicopters, or any tall buildings, Shang Yan called for the entirety of the Qin realm to be divided up. It was as if a Manhattan-style grid was laid down that covered the whole state. And in using this grid, the state was able to divvy out the land to all these peasants anxious to take the government up on this warring state's version of 40 acres and a mule. Once everything was organized, collecting taxes became a cinch, and so tax revenue began pouring into the state coffers. Let me quote one of the great authorities on ancient China here in the U.S., Stanford professor Mark Edward Lewis, who said in his 2007 work entitled The Early Chinese Emperors, quote, "According to one historic source, the grid covered the entire state of Qin. Supporting evidence comes from modern study using large-scale topographical maps to examine the layout of fields in China. It has shown that throughout much of the north, particularly the areas of Qin and Jin, roads and footpaths form a striking rectilineal pattern, everywhere oriented north-south and east-west. Regularity on this scale would have been impossible without state intervention." End quote. And intervening was what the Qin state was good at. Thanks to all the technological inventions discovered, the economic progress made, and the effectiveness with which Xiangyang's reforms were carried out, it was a much different Qin state than before. Soon, they were going to be ready to test their wings. And the great families who had had their way since Yu the Great and the Xia dynasty, no one needed them anymore. Their time had come and gone. The way the system worked now, the peasants, not the nobles, had become the foundation of military and economic power. So what started in the Qi and Chu, Xiangyang took to the next level in Qin. Xiangyang codified his entire philosophy into the Shangjinshu, or just the Shangzi. This work forms the basis of the entire legalist philosophy, later made more famous by Han Feizi. Han Feizi lived from 280 to 236 BCE, dying 15 years before unification in 221. Legalism wasn't pretty, but it was effective, which didn't make it necessarily good, but I guess that's what we have philosophers for. Legalism was most concerned with order in society. Everything sort of spiraled out from that concept. And the whole idea of everyone equal under the law was strictly enforced. And to control the levers of society, a very specific set of codes, laws, regulations were put in place and enforced down to the five-man groups, which represented the smallest cell in the new order. If a peasant followed the rules, there was a lot in it for them. The downside was that a collective responsibility system was also part of the Xiangyang reforms. So if someone in your group committed some sort of infraction or offense, you had to go down with that person. It was harsh. Han Feizi expounded on this more later, but it was Xiangyang who thought he had the human race figured out. People were innately evil, selfish, and never up to anything good. If left to their own devices, the people's wickedness will cause a decay in society to the point where order breaks down. What you needed was a strong and powerful leader at the center of things who knew how to organize the peasants and when to crack the whip and when to give a reward. So this Shangjinshu, or the Book of Lord Shang, explains how the whole thing worked. If you've never heard of Xiangyang, then for sure you never heard of Fan Sui. These two, more than anyone else, made the Qin dynasty. Xiangyang, with his two waves of reforms, put the Qin house in order and put them on a war footing. As I said, he ruffled more than a few feathers and had detractors sufficient enough to cause his speedy and gruesome demise once Duke Xiao died in 338. Fan Sui was someone of high repute as a politician and strategist, also originally from the Wei state. He's remembered for his famous and winning strategy of Yuan Jiao, Jin Gong, make allies of those far away and use them to defeat those who are nearby. This essentially called for an end to the way things had been handled in Qin. Alliances were made for whatever short-term expediency arose, and resources were wasted fighting battles for lands far away that couldn't be held anyway. Fan Sui said you had to expand from the inside out. The states of Wei, Han, and Zhao were too close for comfort. They had to go. To do that, those states who bordered them on the other side of the conflict had to be allied with Qin. And never mind that one day their end would have to come too. The Qin king Zhao Xiang reigned 306 to 251. He's three kings after Duke Xiao. Duke Xiao, by the way, was the last of the dukes. His successor, Hui Wen, adopted the term Wang for his official title, hence King Zhaoxiang. Duke Xiao had Shangyang, King Zhaoxiang had Fansui. After taking a couple of beatings at the hands of the other warring states, and most of all from the neighboring Zhao state, Fansui took it upon himself to travel from Wei to Qin, and he got an audience with King Zhaoxiang and was able to convince him that the methods he was using to attain supremacy were all wrong. He explained his whole Yuan Jiao Jin Gong strategy, and soon after that, the incumbent chancellor was out, and in 266, Fansui was in. Fansui's great achievement was to help facilitate the creation of the autocratic monarch. From the earliest times, no one single man could project power and force his will upon anyone beyond a certain distance. In the decades since Shangyang died, the reforms, despite the occasional pushback, took hold. The state was much more manageable now. Further to that, pioneer peasants from the eastern states had moved to Qin to try their luck. This allowed more land to be cultivated, which led to more grain being produced, and the army kept getting bigger. Not only was this good for the economy, but now a centralized army could be fed by a single king. The need to depend on nobles to fight one's battles became obsolete. Now, full-time professionals who knew their Sun Tzu could be brought into the king's employ and would serve only him. So the armies became much bigger and more professional. And because the organized state was booming economically, the financial wherewithal to field these massive six-figure armies became possible. Then add to the mix all the great technological advances made that enhanced a soldier's effectiveness on the field of battle. Fansui taught his king, if you were able to utilize such shock and awe tactics and overcome your enemy, you had to finish the job down to the last combatant. No one could be left alive to come back and fight you another day. And so, in the mid-3rd century BCE, the period began where you'd have these massive battles and tens of thousands, sometimes more than 100,000, would die in the course of a single battle. And this brutal strategy culminated in 260 BCE at the Battle of Changping, which we'll discuss in the next episode. That battle to end all battles saw the destruction of Zhao at the hands of Qin. Sima Qian said, when it was all over, the Qin killed every last surviving enemy soldier, buried them alive, all 400,000 survivors of the Zhao army. Thanks, Fansui. Once Qin defeated Zhao at Changping, and after they themselves recovered from that Armageddon, there were no other rivals left who could pose any serious threat to Qin. Between 230 and 221 began the War of Unification. Only Qin had reformed like they did, reforming society and reforming the military. And everything now was focused on one single king who had the final say with regard to the taxes and the army. Everything was concentrated in one single person. He ran the system. In the other states, they were still stuck in the Zhou dynasty with enfeoffed nobles and reliance on too many others with their own hidden agendas. There are two more kings to go before the great-grandson of King Zhaoxiang comes to power. This, of course, is Ying Zheng. He takes over from his deceased father in 246 BC and hits the back of the net in 221 BCE. All for next time. There's still plenty more that happens in the Qin between the time Fansui's reforms kicked in and when Ying Zheng anointed himself the first emperor. Next week, we'll finish up on all the other amazing feats and wonders the Qin made before the first emperor takes over. Qin Shi Huang gets way more credit than he deserves. He didn't just appear out of nowhere and carve out this new nation. Improvements to the Qin state had been going on for more than 100 years before Ying Zheng was born. But as we'll see, the first Qin emperor was a perfect capstone to all those reforms. He really took the whole idea of a tyrannical, autocratic monarch to its ultimate level. So, that's going to all be for next time, and I'm pretty sure we could finish off the fall of the Qin next time in part two. If you go check the website or the iTunes feed, you'll see CHP002 on Qin Shi Huang has been cast into the deep, dark pit of CHP Oblivion, along with episodes 12, 21, 43, 54, 74, and 100. Hope you don't mind. I'm not finished yet. I won't say the first Qin Emperor drank these teas, but I wanted to let you know I'm teaming up with the fine folks at teasends.com to bring you not one, but five historic teas of China. The history of each has been covered in the internationally award-winning 10-part History of Tea series brought to you by this very program. Packed inside this lovely wooden gift box are 150 grams. That's 5 1/3 ounces for my fellow Americanskis, of Longjing from the vicinity of West Lake. Not this Sichuan product that's transformed into Longjing using a special Shanzhai process. This is the real thing. Tie Guanying from Anxi and Fujian, Huangshan Maofeng from Anhui, and one of my personal faves, the fabled Da Hong Pao, Big Red Robe Tea from Wu Yishan, Fujian Province, Robert Fortune's old stomping ground. There's also a nice 50-gram brick of a very fine, ripe pu'er. We're also including a loose-leaf ripe pu'er, so you can get a more complete pu'er cha experience. Both brick and loose pu'er tea was grown and packed in tea heaven, Xishuang Banna, in the vacation paradise and birthplace of tea, Yunnan Province. There's also a personal message from your host and humble narrator, as well as a brief history of each of the five teas. Brewing instructions will also be supplied with details about how long to steep each tea, how much to use, and what temperature the water should be heated to. We thought of everything. Hey, don't go through some middleman like me. Go to teasends.com and search for the Historic Teas of China. That's TEASENZ.com. Or just go to the good old CHP website, and I'll have a link directly to the exact webpage where you can get yours. And if I didn't say supplies were limited, you heard it here first. Historic Teas of China, a co-production with TeaSense.com, the people who bring you the authentic Chinese tea experience, and this very China History podcast, consistently voted one of the top 100 China History podcasts on the World Wide Web. That's all I have for you right now. This is Laszlo Montgomery signing off from Gainesville, Georgia again. I can't get enough of the American South. No wonder Jeremy Goldcorn decided to move here. Been downing sweet tea all day and night. Thank you very much. Take care, everyone, and consider joining me next time, won't you, for another exciting episode of the China History Podcast.